Okay, it's 9 o'clock. We're going to call the meeting to order. Good morning. Can we call the meeting to order, please? It's 9 o'clock. We've all got really busy schedules, and I know everybody wants to do our business here and then go on to other things. So we'll call this meeting to order. If we can have a roll call and determination of a quorum, please. I'm not sure we're going to meet the quorum. We do? Okay.
Commissioner Dillon?
Here.
Councilmember Handy Peters?
Present.
Vice Mayor Mathusett? Councilman Enter? Commissioner Curry?
Here.
Mayor Sarzik?
Here.
Vice Mayor McGurk? Councilmember Saylor?
Here.
Commissioner Sowers? Vice Mayor DiLorenzo?
Here.
Councilmember Ford?
Here.
Vice Mayor Long?
Here.
Commissioner Revels?
Here.
Councilmember Patterson?
He is not going to be here.
Councilmember Benny?
Here.
Councilmember Cusack?
Here.
Councilmember Northey?
Here.
Councilmember Wagner? Mayor Ardell? Vice Mayor Rogers? Mayor Jennings? Commissioner Shue?
Here.
Commissioner Lane? Mayor Gibson's excused. Mayor Saul?
Here.
Councilmember Perone?
Here.
Linda Costello?
Here.
Heather Blank?
Here.
Gillis Blaze?
Here.
Bob Stork?
Here.
And we have quorum.
Okay, Ms. Commissioner Mathusett just came in from Deland. Okay. We will please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Do we have any public participation slips filled out today? No? Okay. We will move to the consent agenda, and I want to advise you that the consent agenda includes the annual audit report for the Riverdale CTPO. There were no findings in the report. Alex Kish is here. I think I saw Alex come in earlier. If he's present, if there should be any questions. Otherwise, I will...
Move approval.
Thank you. Move approval of the consent agenda by Mayor Masarsik. Seconded by Commissioner Gilliland, and is there any questions on that? All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion. All those opposed? Motion carries. Okay. We will move to action items. Review and approval of Resolution 2014-35, amending the 2014-15 fiscal year through 2018-19 Transportation Improvement Program, the TIP. This amendment addresses two projects, one an intersection improvement at Old Mission Road and Park Avenue in Edgewater, and two a pedestrian rail crossing at Cali Grande and Holly Hill. And I will ask staff if they could update the board on those two projects.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first project you mentioned, the intersection improvement, we've had a request to withdraw that project. Volusia County and the City of Edgewater are partnering to advance this using local funds only.
Okay.
And the pedestrian rail crossing at Cali Grande, whenever we do work like this, the FEC is actually required to do the work, so we go ahead and put the funding in the TIP, but they do that work and schedule it at their leisure and as their work program permits, and so they have not begun work, so we're just rolling that forward into the existing TIP.
Okay. Are there any questions for staff on either of those issues? Ms. Dennis, did you want to make any comment about the one from Edgewater?
No. Mr. Emter's not here.
Okay. Ms. Curry, anything about the Holly Hill one that you want to add?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Seeing no tents up, I'll take them.
Second.
Thank you, Rob. Seconded by Ron Saylor. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, moving right along, review and approval of the 2015 River to Sea TPO legislative priorities. And if I could have staff give us a brief update on the legislative priorities, please.
Certainly. Each year we develop a set of priorities and positions for the upcoming legislative session. And to remind you of the format that we use and what you see in your agenda is the very first page includes the legislative priorities. These are really the areas and items that we're going to focus our conversations with the legislative delegation in these areas. And there are three items this year. Two of them pertain to funding issues, and then the third is a safety matter. In your agenda packet as well, we have a strike through or a marked up version that tells you what has been added or significant changes for this year. So page one are the priority issues. Then page two on the reverse side are all of the additional positions that we take on different activities that may be taken up during the session. And there's always a lot of activity going on. And some of those are items that we support. In the past, we've had specific items that we have opposed. There are none identified this year. And then there are some items that we know are being discussed, but we haven't actually taken a position on and that we're going to monitor. And then the next two pages give a little more background for those of you that may want to discuss any of these items in your legislative activities or taking back to your organizations. So there are some additional talking points that we provide. What you don't see this year are some items that were there last year, one pertaining to funding for multi-use trails. And the good news is that was actually addressed in the last session, and so it's not necessary to have much of a conversation this year since we made such great progress in the last session. Multimodal transportation options was just moved down to something that we're monitoring. There's not a lot of activity, but certainly in your own communities, at least for some of you, there's still a lot of discussion going on about electric vehicles and golf carts and how they're integrated into transportation. So we want to continue keeping tabs on that if any items do come up. And then finally, under safety, we've focused this year on pedestrian safety only. Last year we had child restraint seats, and again, that was addressed as well in the last session very positively. So if we move to the current set of positions, the very first item deals with funding, and this is continued from last year. We just did make one change, and we specified the flexibility of funding options at both the state and local level, and that is consistent with a position that's being discussed right now through the Florida League of Cities. And the idea here is we have these flat pennies per gallon gas taxes that don't get adjusted very routinely, and if there are any changes made to the taxes that are assessed at the state level, we would like those to also include the local taxes so that they can be pegged to inflation, or at least adjusted more routinely. The second item is the big one being discussed around the state, and that's the Florida Water and Land Conservation Initiative Amendment 1 on the ballot next month. And this had used dock stamps, or at least a portion, a third of the documentary stamps, for a variety of projects that fall under this to acquire conservation. And one of the benefits of that, though, is that it can help to pay for rec trails, recreational trails, as well as the maintenance of trails. So that's a positive. The downside is those dock stamps are used for other transportation programs, such as TRIP and small county outreach. And these are programs that a lot of us through this Metropolitan Planning Organization utilize quite a bit. So we want to monitor that. We want to continue to say, look, let's preserve the existing programs while we carve out that third for some of these other uses, should that pass. And again, on the safety item, if you go to the talking points, which is the last page of the handout, you'll see that right now Florida statutes address what drivers should be doing when pedestrians are attempting to cross a street or enter a crosswalk. And it's not very direct. If you're a driver and you're reading this, understanding when you're supposed to stop, when you're supposed to yield, whether signs are present or not present, it's not very clear. And the fact of the matter is, most drivers aren't reading Florida Statute 316. And so what we're saying is just make it very plain and simple. When a pedestrian is trying to enter a crosswalk, stop. It's what most of us would understand, and I think what a lot of us do, but certainly not necessarily the message that's conveyed clearly to motorists. And so that's what that particular item pertains to. that is it for my presentation and discussion of the items. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions or comments for the staff or for the agenda item? Otherwise, I'll take a motion to approve by Rob Gillen, seconded by Lee Matusik.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Barb's got her. Barb, sorry. Commissioner Revels has got her.
I was up a little late. Is that on?
10 up.
Just under the, on page 41, under the pedestrian safety law, the discussion, it in the different color type under pedestrian safety laws, it mentions, it singles out Flagler County. Have there been no Volusia County pedestrian clashes? I just wondered why Flagler County was singled out there.
I think we've had our fair share.
That's what I was thinking myself.
As you're new.
I'm sorry.
That's right, we're picking on you, Barb.
It just says, safety doesn't happen by accident, ranks Volusia County in the top 10 among Florida's pedestrian crash areas. And though not in the top 10, Flagler County is also recorded bicycle. Does that saying that Volusia County is in the top 10
yes.
and Flagler
yeah.
is not?
Yeah, okay. Volusia is identified in the top 10 and considered a high priority for,
okay.
for the
All
state
right.
DOT. Flagler County is not, but as a part of the pedestrian safety study that we're doing, certainly along A1A, it's been identified as an issue, and there may be some other areas that are a concern.
Yeah,
we have our
problems with that.
Okay,
that's
okay.
all.
Thank
you.
Is that satisfactory,
yep.
Commissioner? Okay. Lee, okay.
Just a comment back on that. We discussed that at the legislative meeting, Barbara, and the concerns were too of, as Lois was saying, of A1A and the hard time of anybody traveling anywhere understanding when to stop and when to yield. And it's not just at marked crosswalks, it's unmarked crosswalks. If you read Statute 316.130, it's confusing to, you know, to anybody. So that was the reason, but it would certainly benefit not only Volusia and Flagler, but the whole state, which is always in the one or two, usually, for pedestrian fatalities.
Yeah, it was a robust discussion. Okay, all those, we'll take a vote. All those in favor of the River to Sea TPO legislative priorities, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Okay, we'll move to item C, review and approval of planning studies request. And I think this is where we got a little balled up last month on this one, so staff, if you would update us, please.
You're correct, Madam Chair. Last month we discussed using a portion of our extra urban funds, the funds that are allocated to a TPO of our size, and we were considering three corridor studies, a pedestrian safety and mobility study on A1A, an intersection study on Belterre Parkway, and a corridor study on State Road 100. And at that point, we were unsure as to whether there was budget authority. And budget authority for DOT means the amount of money that they are allowed to spend under a particular project phase. So each year, they target and get approval to spend a certain amount of money for construction, for right-of-way acquisition, and for planning projects. And the DOT at that point didn't believe that they had any additional budget authority for planning. So even though we have money available and want to switch it, doing that mid-year is not always possible. But they continued to research and found $287,000 of budget authority, which wasn't enough to do all three projects. And so what I moved forward with, based on the conversation by this board last month, was to develop a scope and a project application to the DOT for the pedestrian safety and mobility study on A1A, which of course spans the entire planning area. And that study is estimated at $163,300. And then we continued to work with the City of Palm Coast on the Belterre Parkway intersections study. And we came up with a scope of approximately $75,031. And what we're looking for is support to give direction to DOT to move the $160,000 from the pedestrian set-aside box down to a line item, and then the $75,000 from an ICS traffic ops safety set aside reserve box, again into a planning line item, so that we can go ahead and pursue those two studies during this fiscal year. And then we will develop, and you'll hear this a little later when we talk about the priority process, a list of planning projects for the next upcoming fiscal year that we'll be requesting. And in doing that in advance of the fiscal year, there's a better chance that we'll have budget authority to pursue the projects that we feel need to be pursued.
Okay. Are there questions, Commissioner Revels from Flagler?
So, Lois, what would happen to the Highway 100 study?
It will end up on this list that we're talking about.
Would it receive any priority since it fell out this time?
That would be up to the wishes of this organization, the advisory groups, and the board as well, based on all the projects that end up on that list being requested. But I can tell you that when we originally talked about pursuing corridor studies, that was high up in the mix of conversations, but our planning area was just limited at that point. Now our planning area has grown and it includes more of that particular corridor. And again, that's the type of corridor that runs through a variety of different cities as well as the county. And coordination on a corridor like that is managed by DOT becomes a real challenge. And so doing it as a corridor study makes a lot more sense than doing it.
We would just ask and hope that it be high on the priority list with everyone next year.
Motion to approve.
Okay. Motion to approve. Ron, did you second it? Okay, second it. And I was looking at Council Member DiLorenzo from Palm Coast. Is there any, you look like you wanted to say something?
No.
Fine. Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. All seeing no other tents, all those in favor of the motion? Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Well, we made it through the action items. Now we're moving on to presentation, status report, and discussion items, and we'll have a presentation on the 2040 long-range transportation plan. And it's good morning. Come on down, and we'll
good
talk
morning.
About that.
Yes. Madam Chair, as a part of the 2040 long-range transportation plan, what we do is we estimate future population, where people are going to be residing. Generally based on your comprehensive plans and some other activity. We forecast employment centers and where the employment is going to occur. And then we try to estimate using a technical tool what the demand for transportation is going to be. And so we use this traffic model. And in the past, we have based it on trend information. Again, comprehensive plans, where we have been going and growing in the direction we've been headed. And so we assign all the land use, all the population, and then we try to come up with transportation solutions to meet the demand that's forecasted. But certainly consistent with what you all sort of indicated during the workshop that we did recently, as well as other conversations and things that are happening around the nation, we recognize that where that land use and growth and development occurs directly impacts the demand for transportation. And so this time, instead of taking a single forecast and trying to try different transportation solutions to meet the demand, we're saying, well, what if we change that forecast and we consider people living and working in different areas than the trend indicates? Can we change the transportation outcome as a result? And so we've been meeting with a land use group to develop an alternative land use. And Martha Moore from Giabi and Associates, our consultant for the long range plan, is going to talk a little bit about that activity and the densities that go along with it and these characterization maps that we're developing, again, to consider a different sort of land use future.
Okay, Martha.
Thank you very much. Lois did a great introduction of what it is that we are trying to accomplish with this alternative land use. This just gives us a chance to say, what if, development occurred like this? We're not beholden to the results as they come out. You heard the traffic engineers among us, you probably heard us talk about Z data and socioeconomic sets, and those are pretty fancy terms of just saying where, you know, how many residential units are we going to have, and where are the employment centers going to be? How many people are going to have jobs? And so we've developed, as she said, two sets. We have the trend based on the Bureau of Economic and Business Research totals, based on the census. What is, you know, following along the trend, what has been happening in the past. And then we're also, though, now looking at the alternative land use total. As she said, we're optimizing the land use efficiency and looking at what would happen if development occurred more along corridors of influence, or more of a transit-oriented design, TOD sort of development, say near a potential future SunRail stations, for instance. For the alternative land use, to tie it back, it follows essentially the trend, but we keep the same total number of people. So in that overall Z data or socioeconomic data set, we have the same totals of housing units and the same totals of residents, residential units, employment. But it's where they're distributed within the MPA that is different. And we're trying to, again, highlight development along influential corridors as well as more compact, walkable development, you know, and that focuses on a means of transportation other than just the vehicle, reducing our influence, our reliance on the highway system. Just for your information, when we go through and we talk about what is considered walkable, you know, within about 20 minutes, a person can walk a mile, an average person if they're going 3 miles per hour. You can bike about 3 miles in that 20 minutes, or drive 6 miles. A study was done in Atlanta, and they were looking for a correlation. You know, what kind of results can we expect if we've got a mix of land uses, density of those land uses, and connectivity between different modes, you know, to be able to walk, to be able to bike, transit, rail, as well as vehicles. And they found that those things correlated back to lower vehicle miles traveled. You saw lower emissions, and more walking and bike trips. But what is most important about this study, I feel, is that those correlations were still there, regardless of your household income, the number of vehicles that you had in your household, the household size, and your accessibility to transit. So that's a very good measure for us to consider, that this will hold true no matter where you are in that socioeconomic strata. How are we going to get to our characterization and our alternative land use? We developed, with that land use working group, a characterization framework. And that we identify areas in the future that we feel will be ripe for transit-oriented development. We look at large major employment centers and corridors that are ready for redevelopment. As I said, characterization centers, that bright red in the center, that's what we call the primary transit shed or for transit-oriented development. And the circle around that would be about a half a mile. So that'd be, people could walk within that half mile. You'd see more of a focus on walking in that area. The larger red area, the secondary transit shed, would be more of a biking and bus influence in that area. So we identified within our working group areas we felt would be good for transit-oriented development or major employment centers where we could see greater density. Whoops. And then we also looked at corridors. Where there's existing transit routes, where there could be future, think SunRail routes, areas that'd be good for redevelopment all the way through Flagler County and into Volusia County as well. I know 1792 US 1 corridors in Volusia County, those were certainly some that we considered for this. And then the map was developed for the MPA by our land use working group. That's not just staff that, and Yogi Abhi is consultant that developed this. We also had people from, you know, planners in the area. We've got some citizens that represent, just they're interested. And so we sit around, we've had a couple of different meetings, and we've identified areas within the MPA that we think would be good for greater densities and transit-oriented development. And we've developed the characterization map, and we have that available that we can send out to you if you'd like to comment on it. When we talk about a greater density, this is just some examples for you. This is what would be considered a medium density. This is Welborn Avenue and New England Avenue in Winter Park. You have average 2 to 3 stories of buildings. It's a mixed use. This is probably more familiar to you. This is Ormond Beach on Granada. It's considered medium density. You've got mostly office, two stories average. And then a quite high density development, the most intense use to be considered. This is in Orlando, downtown Orlando. So typical densities that we're talking would be a high density, 5 to 8 stories, medium density, 3 stories, with structured parking. And we're looking at densities in an urban environment with structured parking, not, say, a large building with a bunch of surface parking, because we wouldn't be able to get a greater density if we had that large amount of surface parking. So when I say structured parking, I mean, say, a development with a parking garage. And when it says average story height, that means high density, 5 to 8 stories, you might have some 10 to 12 stories. It's just, you know, some could be taller, some could be lower. It's just an average in there. And what can we expect when we run this trend scenario, the alternative land use scenario? We'll prepare a map that shows the difference in, again, the population and the employment as related to the trend. Right now, we're developing this data set, and we should have the results to bring back to you in early December. But, okay, and this, the areas that are the lighter blue, think of it as a density map. And we're having to keep the same overall totals within the MPA the same. We've got Seminole County here as an example because we don't have our results yet. But the yellow and orange and red represents the densities that are increasing along the corridors. And that's roughly along US 1792 in Seminole, that when they ran the alternative scenario, there was the greater densities of housing and employment along that corridor. Less, you know, in the areas a little farther. And then along the beach there was really no change. What might we expect positive aspects from doing this alternative land use scenario? Well, certainly improved air quality, because we're going to be relying on other forms of transportation like rail, bus, biking, and walking. Improved safety, less of a reliance on vehicles to get around, reduced congestion, and better efficiency of the overall system. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. We're having our land use working group. You're always welcome to come join us at those meetings. We'll have another one, I believe it's scheduled for November 14th.
Martha, when does this come back to us for, I'm assuming, approval or adoption? What is your schedule through the committee's work?
I think a part of what, I'm not exactly sure when the timing is for it to come back for approval or adoption, but what we're trying to do is develop an alternative based on trend, an alternative based on land.
Are you going to use this
and
as
public
we...
involvement?
Okay.
And bring all of that back as bits of data and information to create that
for the
final
overall plan. Okay.
Plan.
Right.
Okay. Yep.
All right. Okay. Questions?
Yes. Yep. Are you developing this plan specifically to identify those areas that are trending that way, or to identify areas that should be developed in the future?
We're using our land use working group, and again, these are local planners, citizens, staff, just to identify areas that are ripe to see more redevelopment. We also know where developments are proposed. The idea of SunRail, you know, where would there be a SunRail station that could serve as a transit-oriented development? So it's kind of a combination of local knowledge and then plans.
So will your recommendations then include or necessitate zoning changes or comp plan changes? No.
Yeah, I would hesitate to use the word should.
Okay.
It's where there's potential. It's where there's an opportunity. And again, what happens, we talk a lot in the planning world about smart growth, and we go through all of these. We have a technical tool where we can really see what the transportation demand, at least according to this tool, is going to be if we develop differently. And so this is, as Martha said earlier, a what if. What if we go in that direction? What does that really do to us? And how do the transportation solutions change if a community heads in that direction? And certainly some of you are looking in that direction, and some of you have changes underway that are kind of trending in that direction or heading in that direction, and we want to be able to test that. But there is no should to it. It gives us one different future and data set to look at and set of information, and you can say, hey, that works, or maybe we need to rethink where we're.
Mayor Masarsik?
Yeah, how, I just wonder how closely aligned this is going to be. We had DOT at our commission meeting Monday night talking about that corridor study, and there's some other studies going on. I mean, are we going to, is there going to be some cross discussions between you all about that? Because that's going to be very dependent on some of the future planning. We come up with a conclusion based on what's there, but that long-term planning corridor study, we talked about everything, bus to rail and everything else out of Newberry. I'm talking about from St. John's River, actually, up over to the east side and up to Flagler with the trains and all. So are they going to look at some of that, incorporate some of those ideas? Is that what you're talking about, like current information?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. When the information is brought to us. Again, this is a question of, and to your planning and technical staff, how do you want that community to look? What do we want to test? If we think there's going to be a community or an area that is more heavily transit dependent, let's put that future population there, A, to support the transit investment, and B, to limit the amount of infrastructure that we have to provide elsewhere. So we should be including all of that, and that's what that characterization map is intended to identify. It's not necessarily development that's already on the ground, but it is in some cases a direction that an area thinks they're going to be headed.
Right, yeah. And at the summit that we had, Senator Simmons was very explicit about pushing, which is something I'll bring up later here, but about alternative modes of getting around bottlenecks on that future study through our city and Newberry or in the city that west side. So
I think what I hear you saying, John, is that you want us to be sure that these studies that we're doing are cross-pollinated and not done parallel.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Saylor, Councilmember Saylor.
I have a question. We're talking about two different studies here.
Right.
And when are both studies supposed to be done by? The date of completion. So when we talk about working together, the completion dates could be something we need to think about.
You're absolutely right, and certainly in this world where DOT is pursuing studies, where some of you locally are pursuing studies, where we through the TPO are pursuing studies, that timing is always a challenge, and a really good example of that is the cross-county systems connector study. It is going to be very tight, and it is quite possible that we can't quite get it to align. And the results of that study may not fit neatly into our plan as we're developing it. And, you know, we do the best we can at any given moment in time, but we recognize we come back to the table every 5 years and we update, right? Last time we didn't have Farmington factoring into the plan at all. This time we do. So, you know, each time we go through this, and then anything that happens in the interim period, as we've done already, is always subject to change. So if something starts to advance faster than we would have thought at this moment in time, we can come back and amend the plan. It's not intended to be a working document, but it can be changed when conditions change.
I guess, Ron, everything's permanent until we change it.
Yeah, that's about the truth of it. Okay.
I just hate to see us cross doing one dot and one I when we should be crossing a T. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think we've sent a message that we'd like us to be working as closely as possible and making sure there's coordination. Oh, the lights came up. Okay. There's no action on this item. And so, Martha, are you doing the presentation on the roundabouts?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm going to let you go ahead and complete that, and then we'll go back to the priority. Okay.
Put on your elevator pedestrian wall for you.
Okay. We'll come back to item B after we, I know Martha's got a busy schedule.
Thank you very much. This is just a quick presentation on roundabouts. I call it Roundabouts 101 because we're certainly seeing more of an interest in doing them in Daytona Beach and other areas. So I just want to kind of walk through what do we mean by roundabout. A roundabout, you know, the basic characteristics of, you have a raised central island, and many times you see that that's used for enhanced landscaping, sometimes statuary, a fountain. It's in the center. You have counterclockwise circulation, of course, unless you're in a place like Scotland or New Zealand, where in which case you need to go the other direction. There's also your entry points. These are low speed, 15 to 20, 25 miles an hour. Those traffic circles and rotaries I hear people complain about are much more high speed. So in this case, again, low speed, you enter sort of as a deflection. We have splitter islands right at the center when you go in that deflect you around. It slows you down, so they're a great traffic calming measure. You know, there's obviously you can't park in the middle of your roundabout, although I have seen them occasionally in small residential areas that have driveways, like residential driveways in there. What am I not talking about today? Well, the rotaries that I just mentioned that connect high-speed roads to high-speed roads. They're much larger traffic circles. Think in Paris, the L'Arc de Triomphe. And then also, we're not saying a small little neighborhood traffic circle that you might have seen that was used for traffic calming. Well, yeah, that's the type of thing you'd probably just drive right through if you weren't paying any attention. A modern roundabout, again, counterclockwise as compared to a traffic circle. The pedestrian movements, you don't see people walking all the way through the center, or you shouldn't see people walking through the center of that modern roundabout. The pedestrian crossings are actually pulled back a little bit. I'm going to go backwards a little bit. The pedestrian crossings are pulled back a little bit before you get to the roundabout itself. There's a splitter island there that serves as a pedestrian refuge. And then our first modern roundabout, as we call it today, was back in the early 1990s in Nevada. Typical roundabouts, you don't see as many mini roundabouts. Certainly in Florida, you've seen, or there have been constructed in the past few years, more of the single lane roundabouts. The diameter of that center island, 90 to 180 feet, multi-lane roundabouts can get quite large and handle substantial traffic volumes, 300 feet across at that center island. And, you know, 45,000 to 70,000 vehicles per day, it's possible to see that on a roundabout. Mythbusters, the TV show you've probably all seen. If you want to watch something fun, certainly Google Mythbusters and roundabouts. And they did a comparison. Certainly, I believe it if they've done it. And they compared a four-way intersection with a roundabout. And they discovered that the roundabout did improve traffic flow at about 20%. I recommend Googling that. You can use roundabouts in a lot of different areas, like at a freeway. Freeway interchanges, high-speed roads, certainly high volume, odd geometry, pedestrians, where you have trucks with schools, gateway into facilities, and also where there's rail. So there's certainly an area that you can consider a roundabout in just about any area. Within Florida, there's actually, I think, closer to 300 or more roundabouts now. 95% of those are on local roads, county roads, not state roads. And 75% of those roundabouts are just single lane roundabouts. But there's been a new policy at DOT that started January 1st of 2013. And in DOT projects, when they're doing their screening, if they're doing a reconstruction or a design project, safety or operational project, they have to screen first for a roundabout. That's considered the first type of traffic control to consider. So certainly the DOT policy has changed. They've retired their old roundabout guide that we used to use 10 years ago. They now follow the national guidance. There's the NCHRP, the National Cooperative Highway Research Program Report 672. That is what we use for design guidance, along with the plans prep manual and the intersection design guide. These are a couple of examples of roundabouts that are in the state. The one on the left is Clearwater, and I think a lot of people have probably heard about the one in Clearwater. That's got 6 points of entry into it with some fairly major roads. And then on the right is a single lane that's in Jacksonville. This one on the right does show the presence of bike lanes. I've had that question. So I'm like, you know, we've talked about pedestrians, we talk about vehicles, what happens to bicycles? And you have two choices. You can come up in the bike lane, and it sort of tapers off right at the ADA ramp to the sidewalk. You can either get off your bike, become a pedestrian, walk your bike around the roundabout, get back on, and go back in the bike lane. Or you have the option of going through it as a vehicle and following all the same traffic laws. Some of the advantages that you might see from a roundabout: safety, lower speeds certainly leads to that, better less delay because you have better progression through the roundabout. You're not sitting at a, you know, a traffic light waiting on it to change, so you have a decrease in emissions, better fuel mileage, better economy. You can use them for aesthetic purposes with landscaping or you know, improvements that way. And you don't have as many maintenance costs because you're not paying for the maintenance and the cost of that traffic signal and the mast arms. For safety, with the slower speeds, that gives you more time to see people, see pedestrians, other cars in the intersection. Gives you a little more time to make a decision about whether entering or not. There's been, in studies, they show over 90% reduction in fatalities at intersections by using roundabouts, 76% reduction in injuries. If we compare conflict points, this is for vehicles, between on the left is an intersection, on the right is a roundabout, there's a difference of 32 conflict points for vehicles with a typical four-way intersection, and 8 for a roundabout. So that's a reduction of 75%. And then if we look for pedestrians, there are 16 conflict points for pedestrians, 8 in a roundabout, so a reduction of 50%. So we're increasing pedestrian safety. And the pedestrian really only has to look in one direction, because what is the one of the biggest problems at intersections are drivers sitting here. They want to turn right. There's a pedestrian or a cyclist here, and they're too busy looking to the left for an oncoming car. And they do the famous right hook. They turn to the right while looking that way. And then there ends up being an injury or an accident. So those are eliminated at this roundabout. This is very important. That has been shown, the lower speeds lead to fewer pedestrian deaths. If you're going 20 miles per hour, 9 out of 10 pedestrians survive that. But if that speed goes up to 40 miles per hour, only 1 out of 10 pedestrians can survive that type of crash. Whoops. However, you know, there are some issues associated with roundabouts, you know, with safety, and that is that the vehicles don't have to stop when they come up to it. They have to give way to the vehicles that are already within the roundabout, but they can enter. They don't have to completely come to a stop to give a pedestrian a gap to cross. And also, there can be issues with the visually impaired pedestrians. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But some of our advantages, again, reduced delay, reduced travel time. As compared to a four-way stop where everyone has to stop in a roundabout, you're always going to have a better travel time and less delay, and certainly better. Most of the time better with a two-way stop, and then usually the delay is better than at a signal. Lower delay means less emissions. Those upper two lines represent delay at a traffic signal, and at the bottom, that's due to a roundabout. So certainly, improved air quality, less delay. We've had studies that do show that you get reduced fuel consumption at roundabouts and lower emissions. Where can you put roundabouts? I don't want to say that a roundabout is a solution for every intersection, but certainly they can be appropriate in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. A typical single-lane roundabout would be entering volumes around, say, 1,800 vehicles per hour, but they can certainly go up much higher with multi-lane volumes, up to 8,000. You want to put it at roads that have roughly the same functional classification, so you don't want to mix a small local road with a big arterial. And you can have them with certainly all levels of pedestrian volumes. Where you shouldn't, if you have a traffic signal system, they're all coordinated, it's working well, that's good. You need to be concerned about area intersections where there are a lot of driveways. You don't want people waiting to turn left into a driveway, or even right, and backing up traffic through the queue. If there's a presence of a railroad track close to that intersection, you wouldn't want vehicles, if they back through the roundabout, to go across that railroad track. And certainly there are some areas with the geometry or the right-of-way that just would not accommodate a roundabout. However, you certainly can put roundabouts with unusual geometry. If you have a lot of left turns, great place to put a roundabout. Near schools and playgrounds gives you a chance to do traffic calming, and that is certainly a good roundabout. And then small commercial corridors, a lot of times they're used to slow down traffic and also as a feature, you know, certainly a gateway feature. These are a couple of examples of a well-designed roundabout versus a not well-designed roundabout. And on the left, you can see that there's not a truck apron Typically, if you have a lot of truck traffic, you'd have a raised truck apron around the center island. And you can see the wheels of that vehicle going all over that very pretty landscaping. But on the right is a well-designed, and you can get a big semi-wheeler through that roundabout. A lot of times when we start talking roundabouts, people will say, oh, God, I hate it. I don't want to see a roundabout. No, no, no. And so they've done some surveys and discovered that, you know, very negative or negative opinion before the roundabout is constructed. We're talking over two-thirds of people saying, absolutely not, don't do this. After it's constructed properly, that flips right back around, and you see that everyone is positive. Well, there are no negative feelings about it in the study. It pretty much goes to 70% of people being very positive about having that roundabout. For the visually impaired, like we talked about earlier, I know Daytona Beach has such a population of the visually impaired, the mobility impaired residents. We have a lot of services for those residents. And so if you're at a typical intersection, there's a light, you get the gap in traffic, you can cross. You can hear traffic stopping, and you've got those cues. But you don't have that in roundabouts. And that's certainly a problem that you have to be able to sense the gap. You have to know they're not going to stop for you in a roundabout. If you have a really large multi-lane roundabout, you have to go around a lot longer. And if you're mobility impaired, that can be a problem. But ADA does require that roundabouts be designed to be used by people with disabilities. There's been a lot of study lately that's still ongoing to try to decide how those issues can be dealt with. You know, we don't have a perfect answer yet, but they're certainly being studied at the national level. These are some examples of my favorite roundabouts. We have the L'Arc de Triomphe in Paris. That's a traffic circle, actually. There's a really awesome one there in Shanghai on the right. That outer ring that you see is actually a pedestrian bridge. All those dots are pedestrians that are up there. And then my very favorite roundabout, which I think exists only on the internet, is the Blondie roundabout. So.
That's not funny, but go ahead.
And I'd be happy if you have some questions too.
Okay, any questions? And staff, did you want to add anything to this, Lois?
I do not. Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to give some thought to this, especially as there's going to be a greater emphasis going forward.
Yeah. Oh, Ms. Denny's?
Thank you. And this is not a blonde comment. However, with the roundabouts, the only, and I agree with you, I've been in small towns, large towns with the roundabouts, the only negative to it is how we handle the signage. Because once you get in a roundabout, trying to determine where you're going to exit from the roundabout, the issue is not with the roundabout, the issue in getting in, it's exiting and how well those exits are marked. And I have to tell you, even with my GPS on my phone, you know, we were in North Carolina in a roundabout, and it was not well marked. And I'm telling you, people were going around and around.
Was it low speed? Because that certainly makes a difference. If a traffic circle gets really high speeds and people are sort of changing lanes, they're much larger, and that gets way confusing.
It wasn't an issue of changing lanes. It was an issue of reading
signage.
And determining where to exit. So navigating the roundabout is as important as everything else, the ground that you're looking, you know, everything that you showed us. The critical piece to this is going to be how to navigate the roundabout.
And speaking of navigation, if you're entering the roundabout, you have to yield to people that are already
correct
within the roundabout. We hope that you're not circling, you know, continually around the able. But certainly signage is important, and if you're familiar with the area, know, all right, I'm going through, my road is over there. That's important to know, I think.
And if it's a large roundabout and you're in the inside and you need to exit here to the right, I mean, it's the negative to this is, at least with an intersection, you're forced to come to a stop and then, you know, a look at the traffic pattern. With the roundabout, there's continual movement, and then the continual movement is where some of the adverse relationships are. So I'm just saying, for the record, signage is a critical piece of this.
And the slow speeds, the 15 to 20 miles per hour that you get in the roundabout, do give you a little more time to, you know, they're slower and see the signage. But it's very important to have things properly signed.
Thank you. Rob?
Is there any data on bicycle safety in roundabouts versus intersections? Because it sounded like they aren't very bicycle friendly. You know, you kind of get off your bike and walk across, or you can get into traffic. So
I don't have statistics with me at the moment, but yes, I'm sure there are information specifically as related to cyclists.
You can send something maybe to Lois just to share with the group.
Yeah, we can look that up specifically,
that
but
up.
That is how bicyclists
they operate.
Manage now. You know, under Florida law, they're on the road, they're a vehicle, and that's usually where an experienced cycler will go. And then those that are a little less comfortable can get off at certain points and operate. But when you're on a sidewalk, you have to operate like a pedestrian. And so it's consistent, really, with what's happening now. But how
the
that
bicycle
really
lanes going away prior to the roundabout and then getting into the traffic lane is a little different because we do have bicycle lanes that go through intersections.
Sometimes.
Jason?
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Some comments?
I just want to make the comment that they've been around for a very long time. I'm kind of surprised how enamored we are of them. What's changed? What's new? We have ignored them for many decades, and all of a sudden, they're like the flavor of the week. So I'm a little interested in how our transportation engineers through many decades have essentially ignored them, and all of a sudden, they're becoming very popular. What's happened?
I think the rest of the world was probably a little ahead of us on these in the sense that when I first became a traffic engineer in the early 90s, I'm not going to say when exactly, but anyway, I met an Australian engineer. He's still here in Florida, Michael Walwork, working with the DOT District 2 at the time, and every intersection he was saying, this would be a roundabout, we should consider a roundabout here. And at the time, we would go, yeah, Michael, nice, you know, we're never going to do that. And times have changed. People are traveling more, you're seeing more of them. I can't speak exactly to why the department's policy changed, but if Jean or Claudia from the DOT can maybe speak to that.
Actually, it's just because we've had more people come and ask for them. That's honestly, we're looking at them again because people are coming and asking for them.
Okay, I mean, I'm not knocking them. I think if we can move cars quicker and easier, I think that's fantastic. I'm just a little intrigued at how they've been around forever and we've ignored them if they're so great. So it'll be interesting to see how these develop and what the studies show. Thank you.
They're very popular in the Middle East where they're doing new development, new roads are going in. When I was over there, they're using them everywhere. So that might be part of it too, just trying to retrofit our existing road network. So. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
All right, we'll go back to item B. Presentation on priority process program changes, and Ms. Bollenbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Each year, we issue a call for projects, and we develop project priority lists, and this is how we communicate our priorities to the Department of Transportation, and they use these lists to develop their work program. This is where the projects really get funded. And the start of this cycle begins with us reviewing our process and our policies and practices and developing our that policy direction to start the call for projects. And so we've been meeting with a subcommittee to review what's happened in the last call and to see if there are any improvements that can be made. Likewise, changes that are going on here in the state and making sure that we're reacting to those. Much like we did last year with the Trails program. And so in your agenda packet, there is sort of a summary of where that subcommittee stands right now with different issues that they've been deliberating about. And I'm not going to read through all of these items, but there are a couple that I want to just bring up. And if there are any comments that you all have, the committee, I think, would welcome any sort of feedback to make sure that they're bringing to you the sort of recommendations that you might be looking for. And the first item is B and C, under item number one, items B and C. And the idea here is our priority lists have developed over time based on the funding that's been available. And we've really narrowed that SU set-aside, again, that money that comes specifically to this TPO. And so our bicycle and pedestrian priority list are for projects trying to apply for that money. It's not necessarily bicycle and pedestrian priorities that would be open for other funding sources. And there are other funding sources available. And as we've talked about, the state has changed to allow state transportation funds to be used for trail projects. And so what we've talked about is broadening that, not restricting it just to XU or SU money, but broadening that into a more comprehensive priority list that can access other funding sources. That would include prioritizing bicycle and pedestrian projects on state roads that would be using state road money. It gets a little bit challenging when we start talking about local matches for those sorts of projects, because local governments don't necessarily want to provide a local match for a state road project. So we're working through some of the details there, but again, we're talking about sort of uncoupling or loosening that priority list, as well as the ITS traffic ops priority list, again, to make sure that we have projects that can access a greater list of funding sources. Okay, moving on to item E, which is the protected status. Each of our lists, as projects move up, get into a top ranking section. And the idea is once you've waited your turn and the project has moved along and you're getting close to funding, we don't want to re-rank that project and have it pulled from the list. At that point, usually local governments are starting to do design, they're starting to work that project into their work schedule. And so we have this protected class. But every now and then, we get a project that gets in there, and each year when funding comes, the local government says, not this year, not this year. And the project starts to become stale. It takes up a space and prevents other projects from moving up. And the whole idea is to keep these moving along. And so the committee is discussing the possibility or the recommendation of, after 5 years, if you've sat there and you've passed your turn, your project gets removed, you can reapply if it is a priority or if you want to continue pursuing it. Now, they're not talking about taking projects out that haven't moved forward because there hasn't been funding. They're talking about projects where the local government is just not moving forward with it for some reason, not willing to provide a local match. Moving on to the next page under item F, 1F, again, this is the issue that we ran into this year, or that I shouldn't call it an issue, but the situation we discussed this year, and that is where we have these projects that are not really traffic operations projects. They're not smaller projects. They're larger operational, and when I say larger, I mean in terms of funding. And the committee has agreed that those should probably be included in the long-range plan and be drawn from the long-range plan because of the amount of funding that's typically attached. And these would be major roundabout projects, complete streets projects, maybe comprehensive ITS projects, things that are of a greater scale. DOT runs into this sometimes. They have a push-button program for smaller projects, and every now and then they get an intersection project that they can't fund through that program. But there's no mechanism through the TPO. And so we want to go ahead and identify and make sure that there is an opportunity for those projects that are somewhere in between. Moving down to item 2A, and there's a question about, again, if we uncouple the lists and we broaden them, should DOT staff be able to actually apply? We're still setting priorities, but should DOT be able to recommend a project on a state road, a bicycle and pedestrian project, and fill out that application? So again, we're kind of talking through the pros and cons of doing that. In the past, what we've done is had DOT work through a local sponsor. And the local sponsors are challenged by that situation because then they're being asked to shepherd a project through that really didn't come from them. They're supportive of the department, but they're really not familiar enough with the scheduling and interested in getting themselves as a middleman, if you will. Moving further along to item C and the idea of cost overruns, we're kind of broad with our definition of what a cost overrun is. It's basically you ask for a certain amount of money, $1 million, and your project costs more than that. It's considered a cost overrun, period. The question is, we have a policy that says cost overruns fall on the responsibility of a local government unless there is something that has been unforeseen. And at that point, the local government comes back and asks for an adjustment. There is some question about whether that's being applied across the board and how it's being applied. And so there's some discussion about having some more definition about that, when it is an issue or not an issue. So those are kind of the summary of the issues that they're discussing. I'd be happy to entertain any questions or any thoughts or suggestions that you might have that I can bring back to the committee.
And this is, they're still meeting on this. We're taking any input from the board here that will go back to them, and then this comes back to us
next
for
month.
Adoption in November.
Typically in November, we bring back the resolutions that outline funding, that
right.
outline the process.
Okay.
And so the resolutions and the applications themselves come through this board for any
okay.
final.
Commissioner
we'll,
Revels,
of course, review those
again. Do you have a question?
Sort of a typographical thing. On page 56, item D, I think that there should be something on the end of the sentence where it says and 30%, and I think when you read below it says for transit projects.
Thank you.
Is that it? Okay, Lee? Ms. Matusik?
Has this been reviewed also with the TCC and the CAC? I know that there's probably people on that subcommittee, but has this gone through those committees, or will it go through before it finally gets to us? Because some of this is a little over, I think, where I'm at as well, where I look at the TCC, that some of this would make more sense.
Yes, it has, and yes, it will again. We brought this same item and through the Citizens and Technical Advisory Committees. We'll bring it through the BPAC as well, since they review those particular items related. And then we'll be bringing everything back through all of those committees next month prior
okay.
to bringing it to the board. Absolutely.
Okay. This was for presentation, and we will see this again as an action item, if I understood you correctly, next month. Okay. Okay. I believe that concludes the presentations and discussion items. We'll go to FDOT report. Mary?
Good morning. Mary Schosa with the Florida Department of Transportation. I'm subbing for Claudia Calzaretta, who is out of the office today. I do not have any construction projects that have started this month that I need to report on or that have finished this month, but I'm here to take any questions or concerns you may have back to the office to get answers for you if anyone has any.
Any questions for Florida Department of Transportation? Lois?
Just to add to that for the members, we had a lengthy discussion at the executive committee meeting, and we have invited Frank O'Day to come to the meeting next month, and he has confirmed that he'll be coming and giving a comprehensive update on all of the major CIS projects that we have underway, because we have a lot of activity, huge, in this area. Not only with the end out of this area, with the I-4 ultimate plans, construction, as well as the PD&E, the widening of I-95, the ongoing construction on I-4, the Matanzas interchange. And so he'll be coming in and giving a much more detailed presentation on all of those projects.
Okay, that's good to know. Other, Ms. Matusik, I thought I saw your...
I was going to bring that up and Lois addressed
okay.
it. So.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary, we appreciate it. Move to the Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first item is the Coast to Coast Summit, and there was a wonderful summit put on by DOT on October 1st, and our Chair, Pat Worthy, attended, as well as Commissioner Matusik. And I just wanted to let everybody know that there is still a great emphasis on moving that project forward, and if either of you wanted to share anything about that summit.
Just that it was wonderful to see everybody. I mean, the room was overflowing. There was a lot of energy and enthusiasm for getting it done, and we still have, I think, an issue here in Volusia County as to the entrance point. I did speak with Jim Woods, who is now FDOT. Correct. He moved over. He was with DEP about adding Edgewater as entrance point for the for the Coast to Coast. He has advised me that Titusville is the official one, so if we want to do something, and we're, I think, going to be in better shape than Titusville is as far as making the connection, we need to set up a strategy on how we can convince them that there are two entrance points for the coast-to-coast connector, Titusville and then Edgewater and eventually, hopefully, New Smyrna Beach, when Edgewater and New Smyrna Beach connect, okay? So that was what my takeaway from it was, that we have some work to do in Volusia County to make sure that we have, while we have a number of miles of the connector throughout our county, we also have the resources in hotels, beds and breakfasts, restaurants that will be needed by those who will be using the coast-to-coast connector, as opposed to Titusville, where it goes through Merritt Island Refuge, which is a beautiful refuge and certainly should be included. But I think we have a lot to offer as well. So I don't know. Ms. Matusik, did you have
anything? Titusville has, you know, it's not only the refuge they're trying to get through, it's the Kennedy Space Center as well. So
three federal agencies they have to go through.
So, you know, I'm on the same with Pat that, you know, we really need to push and work and make the Edgewater-New Smyrna connector a priority, because I think that's going to really help all of Volusia County as being that connector. And I strongly feel if we can get there before Titusville can get there, they would really almost have to recognize that, because they won't have an entry otherwise. So I know Titusville's been working hard. They, you know, they were on top of the project in the beginning, just like we were. The only other question that I had, and it came through part of Stephen's presentation there, who did a great presentation. It was really nice to hear the MPO representatives or the DOT specialists of each of those areas that this whole coast-to-coast is going to go through and what they're looking at. But the possibility of some funding issues that we thought were complete but may not be on part of our county connector.
We don't have the details. What Commissioner Matusik is referring to is it looks like there are some cost overruns on the section of the East Central Florida Rail Trail that comes through Volusia County, and I think county staff is still assessing the details of that. And eventually, when that is narrowed down or nailed down, that'll have to come back through in the form of an amendment to the TIP and approval of this board. But again, it's an important gap, and we want to make sure that we understand what the cost issues are. And
there's a number of bridges through that section, and there are, I think, two trailheads. And it's my understanding that FDOT is not participating in the trailheads, and that maybe is where the issue is. So.
Right,
we're
so, the,
on
so
it.
The dollar value isn't clear at this point. How much is the trail itself, and how much is affiliated or associated with the trail heads? And so those may have to come through as separate funding sources if they come through this group.
So does that affect the timeline that we've been looking at for completion?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I'm not aware of that, no. No, we're still moving forward. And did you want to comment on the study over St. John's Bridge on the west side connecting to Seminole County, where we're at with that?
Right. During the last legislative session, there was an appropriations for the coast-to-coast itself of roughly $15 million, and that was assigned to a variety of different projects. And one of those projects is the bridge between Volusia and Seminole County, and really from where the Spring Trail stops at Lake Monroe Park, getting through the park and then over the bridge. All assessments of the bridge seem to indicate that it is wide enough to include the trail across. So there's not necessarily a huge construction element or reconstruction element that's going to be necessary, but how to make that connection, how to properly mark and create a safe avenue, how to get through the park, and then how to connect on the other side, still needs to be determined. And so right now, they've allocated a small amount of money to do that initial engineering work. And then once they do that initial engineering work, they'll have a better idea of what the cost for those improvements will be, and then we'll see funding for that. And that right now is really identified as the only unfunded gap for this particular area.
Lee?
Where are we with Duke Energy? I know that was, it was really interesting. The over on the West Coast, and Pat and I were sitting there with our eyes open, that Duke Energy was really working and participating and giving right away, and there had been a slower start over here with Duke Energy.
So I'm hopeful that we have, I talked to Laura Beauvais, who is kind of the Duke Energy person for this project, several times. We were out on the ground. The original alignment that the county was looking at was not going to work. It was just way too wet. So we're looking at additional alignments and working through the access issue on the northern end of the Duke Power Plant with them. There were some emails going back and forth requesting some additional information and some overheads of actual aerials. And it leads me to say, Lois, maybe, I don't know what our calendar looks like for next month, but perhaps we should bring in the county to do an overview. We did this at the West Volusia Summit, and I thought it was well received, and maybe we should do that here as to the trails projects in Volusia County as part of the Coast to Coast and the Spring to Spring. And so that's agreeable with everybody, because that's an important piece, and it's a little bogged down. So we're working on it, though.
And to that note, again, we are pursuing a regional trail corridor assessment as well. Again,
yes, that would be good for the update. Yeah.
Momentum here in the state, and we're trying to make sure that
for
we're really clear
see, yeah.
in this entire planning area where all of our regional trails stand and what needs to occur to actually have them be projects on the ground. Yeah.
Okay. What else would you like to talk to us about? Oh, I'm sorry, Deb. I missed you, Ms. Dennis.
Madam Chair, just a quick note. In the Coast to Coast Summit, was there any conversation, since the New Smyrna Edgewater piece seems to be integral, and I agree with you, for entryway, on the Park Avenue situation recommendation of taking that middle lane out?
No, there wasn't any detailed discussion on that. We have, the TPO staff has met with Edgewater and New Smyrna staff to talk about how to make that connection from Rotary Park on Park Avenue up through New Smyrna and to the coast. There are some challenges there. We'll have that discussion again as a part of the regional trail corridor assessment, and hopefully eventually we will have a hard project that we can start to pursue. I think New Smyrna has several alignments that they're comfortable with pursuing. The question is, from Rotary Park to any one of those alignments, how do we get north? And there are a couple of alternatives. They just need to be vetted.
And Deb, that would not have been discussed there because they're not recognizing the Edgewater link as part of the Coast to Coast. That's my comment, that we've got to figure a way to get that in there so that an entrance point is New Smyrna Beach Edgewater. Now they're only looking at Titusville.
So that's the missing piece.
Yes.
And that's actually the defining piece, which is why
it's critical that
it's why it's critical, and they could override what happens on Park Avenue. Is it?
No, I don't think that. No. They're not interested in the local details. They're just, but we didn't talk about it because it's not part
it's
of that.
Not identified.
Not identified mm-hmm. yet.
Okay.
So
because Edgewater isn't actually the coast.
The coast, right?
And that's where bringing in New Smyrna.
That's critical.
Makes it coast to coast.
And I did have a conversation with the city manager for Edgewater when we were down there for the ribbon cutting for the Dunkin' Donuts, and I know he's working with Pam over in New Smyrna Beach, and they have identified an alignment up to, from what I understood from Tracy, up to New Smyrna Beach, where municipal boundary. So, Jason, if you can do anything to encourage your staff to to make that connection or make that alignment happen on the ground so that we can start working on.
Well, absolutely, and I'd be surprised if, is, for clarification, is the confusion between Rotary Park to New Smyrna or once we get to New Smyrna?
I think he has an alignment that gets to, from my conversation, that gets us to New Smyrna at 10th. Is that where the 10th Avenue? Is that where the
10th Street?
10th Street, yeah.
U.S. Where are you in going, US, Riverside or U.S. 1?
I thought it was U.S. 1 side, but I didn't have a map in front of me. We were just having a general conversation.
Well, you could get from 10th Street. I mean, I'm not sure where the.
Okay.
I'll follow up okay. with you, but. Let me know.
It might be interesting to have the information for next meeting if we can have a small discussion.
And I think maybe what Deb's talking about, there seems to be an issue with the alignment on Park.
Yes.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
There is.
Yeah.
Taking it off because of right of way is going to take a lane out in it, which is something different than the whole scenario part. Right.
But it's part of the whole process, and it's critical to the city of Edgewater and to the whole industrial complex down there. I mean, this is a big issue, especially when there's an alternative, you know, or an alternate possibility there.
Okay. Well, we'll work with Edgewater on that. Okay. What else do you have for us, Ms. Spolbeck?
I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware of the impact to the TPO regarding the closure of VCOG and the termination of that organization. We have co-located offices with VCOG for well over 20 years. We entered into this particular lease agreement with the recognition that they were an organization that was going to share this office suite, and that's been a great arrangement all these years. But now with that organization closing, we will have some office space available. We are currently trying to bring another tenant in or see what sort of changes we can make to offset the reduction in revenue that we get from that shared expense. And I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware that is roughly $30,000 of a deficit to this organization going forward. Our current lease arrangement doesn't expire until April of 2018, so we'll be under that situation for a while unless we get a tenant in here, and as I mentioned, we are trying to do that. We will probably be coming back in some coming months with some sort of a budget amendment if we are not able to find a way to retain that revenue somewhere else. And again, I just wanted to make sure you all were aware of that.
And let me go to Jason.
Just some clarification, was VCOG on the lease or were we subleasing to them? What was their responsibility for that?
We are the holders of the lease and we don't have a formal arrangement.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay,
what else?
And the other item was going to be an update on SunRail. Can you bring it up? And in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and make this brief. Each month, though, there is a presentation that's given to a technical committee as well as to representatives on SunRail, and this information is available to everyone on the SunRail site. So quickly, what I wanted to just give you an idea for those of you that don't attend these meetings, what sort of information is shared. And what you might be interested in seeing, this is a table that includes daily boardings for the month of September. And what you'll see at the very top is the DeBary station with over 8,000 boardings for the month continues to be the busiest station, which is good news. The other station that is also and a close second is Sand Lake. These are both end of the line stations. So, of course, you've got a shed that's a little broader than maybe some of the others. Some of the other stations are really getting a lot, are their destination stations and a lot of transfers and things to other activities. On average, 15 wheelchair boardings a day. On average, over 90% on-time performance, which is typically the threshold in transit. Bicycles, over 200 bikes, or roughly 200 bikes a day. As far as parking lot counts, they take these counts pretty routinely, and you'll see the DeBerry station for the month of September was at just under 60%. Prior months, the percentage was a little higher. There are activities underway right now through the Department of Transportation to expand that parking, because certainly there's a recognition that when construction begins on I-4 in the Orlando area, which is going to happen just after the new year, that may slow traffic down, and that may encourage some people to think about using SunRail that hadn't perhaps tried it before. So you can see on average, the ridership, daily boardings through September 1st, the average is 3,800, just almost 3,900, which is just shy of the 4,300 that was predicted or estimated for the first year. So again, it's fairly good news. Now, it's been declining since the start of service. However, transit tends to be cyclical, and so that may just be a result of the typical cycles that we will see. They've had some issues with the ticket vending machines, with some of their data collection. They're continuing to work on those issues. They're really trying to pressure, I think, the firms to give good information, and DOT is doing what they can. They have, for those of you that are familiar with this, they had ambassadors out on the platforms, and they ended that for a while, and they got some pretty quick feedback that ambassadors were needed again. And I'm not sure if they've started again, have
not
they,
yet,
Mary? But just trying to work through the contracting and funding of that and get them back out there. The big focus right now, I think, or one of the big focuses, aside from the operations themselves, is really to try and improve safety. There's a lot of new and different activity out there, and people are not accustomed to it, and they've had some conflicts as a result. In 2013, you can see that's when the conflicts really started to rise. Well, that's really more associated, as you can see, objects in the corridor. This was during that construction phase when they were double tracking, and so there were some issues associated with that. But once rail started, you see that we have some other conflicts with people being on the tracks, and they're doing everything they can, again, to try and get the word out, not to stay on the track and not to try to cross the track. These trains go faster. They're more frequent, and again, there is an adjustment period. Now, typically, just like we do on the highway side of the house, we don't just look at the numbers. We look at the numbers based on 100,000 miles traveled. We look at transit based on hours of operating service. These are raw numbers. They're not based on the amount of service. So what we've seen is conflicts increase as activity is increased, but that hasn't been normalized yet. Again, we're still really early in the operations of this particular service. Service enhancements right now, they monitor the ridership every day, and when they start to exceed 85% of the capacity on trains, they add trains to the train set. So they're, again, being very responsive operationally. They do have all of the train sets and cars that they need to bring the service through phase two. So there are additional cars available when there are peak periods or any activity, again, where the capacity needs to be increased. They're currently considering evening and weekend service. There's been a lot of requests for expanding service. They're looking at that. Obviously, the original arrangements were based on the service that is currently out there. So we know that at the end of 7 years, DOT is not going to operate the service anymore. So I think they're very cautious about considering any additional enhancements that somebody else will have to take over in the long run. There's just some additional information. And again, I just wanted to give you an idea of the information that gets presented each month for those of you that don't have staff or aren't attending actually yourselves. Phase 2 South, which is continuing from Sand Lake Road down into Kissimmee, was included in the president's budget last year, so that's going to be moving forward. Phase 2 North, preliminary engineering plans are underway. They expect to apply for a Small Starts grant at the beginning of next year. Obviously, whether that project moves forward will be dependent on whether it gets included in the president's budget. Then some intersection ideas. And then there's a phase 3, which is a connection to the Orlando International Airport, and that's currently being studied, which is intended to connect to a terminal expansion that's occurring at OIA. And that's all I have in terms of the SunRail.
And does that get put up on the website? Will that be available on the TPO website if somebody wants to peruse it?
We can get that put on our website. All of the presentations and activities, this is a part of a SunRail working group, and they're all available on the SunRail,
site.
Website as well, but we can certainly link more clearly to that tomorrow.
Okay. Lee?
Maybe with an explanation on the TPO website with a link directly over.
Yeah, that would be good.
Way, if somebody was interested,
could go there.
There instead of looking at that one monthly.
That's good. That's a good idea. Okay, we're coming to the end of our meeting, and we will go to River to see board member comments, and we'll start down there with Barbara coming this way. Anything?
Nothing at this time. Thanks.
Mayor? Did you have something you were going to bring up?
Not bring up, but I'd just like a little more information on the plan that staff has with this League of Cities, VCOG, and TPO agreement here. I know there's a lot of information out there, but we need to maybe make some.
We'll be discussing that at the executive committee meeting. We had gone before the VCOG board to ask them to make us whole, and they declined to do that. So I know.
I didn't want to get into the politics of that, but I'm just wondering if there's a possibility. You know, long term, we're looking at a very expensive thing. We're really not an organization, a planning organization. We're not a landlord, so
right.
I know right now you're doing your best to try to find somebody to fill in because of the lease, but we need to maybe make tentative offers to our landlord, so to speak, about our situation and the possibility of trying to, you know, get out the length of the lease or whatever, or let it be available. I don't know. It's for the executive committee, but I just want to get an update every month on that so we know where we're going.
Good. We can. Lee?
There was a preview of the new Riverdale Lakes Heritage Corridor, a DVD done of that whole corridor from DeBarry all the way up to Edgewater and Seville, and it takes in a lot of our planning area and there along 1792, and I think it was very well done, and it really shows what is available for somebody to come and making that a destination. So I've got an extra copy, so I can leave it here, and if anybody wanted to see it, it's about 30 minutes, so I certainly wouldn't recommend showing it at the TPO, but I can make one available to you if anybody wanted to.
It was a good video.
It was an excellent video.
Can I borrow one?
Mm-hmm.
We can get you one. Deb, we'll get a copy to you.
Let's get copies.
Yeah, we can do that.
I've got an extra one. I'll just drop it over at your office there in DeLand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. McWhirt? Mayor?
I just want to put a quick plug in. If you need pumpkins or gourds, please stop by Lillian Place 1884 Museum. I've got a truckload, and it's good
prices.
She
has to get rid of them.
You've got to get rid of them. I feel like Linus waiting for the great pumpkin buyer to come. Thank you.
Marshall, anything? Penny, Ron?
On the Florida League of Cities Transportation Committee, it has been a very hot item on the trust fund expenditures and not getting it. So it's kind of interesting to hear it on our priorities, so where there is more than one person yelling about it.
Great. Deb?
Just for clarification, on Park Avenue, we put the resolution through County Council, and it's in our packet, and I missed my opportunity when you called on me earlier on page 117 of our package. The Volusia County resolution is included for information, and it's dated on, I guess it's page 27 of our agenda. With this resolution and with the City of Edgewater's resolution on Park Avenue, what this does basically is, because we freed up those dollars in the TPO, we freed up those dollars since the city partnered with the county. When we go forward with three-laning Park Avenue, which is why I keep coming back, this is all intertwined, we freed those dollars up to use them as match dollars for the future for that endeavor. So is that a correct conclusion?
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
Lois, is that our correct understanding?
I'm not exactly sure when you say you freed them up to be used as match dollars. I'd have to double check to see whether that is a project that's available for something like a TRIP program, which is a 50-50 match. That is available because it is a federally qualified road as a traffic operations project through our programs, but it is a local road and is currently funded through the long-range plan with local funds.
Right.
And we can't just then move it to a federal or there isn't state funding, but another program. TRIP funds, that's separate because that is applied for. So again, when you say we freed those dollars up to be used as a match, I'm not exactly sure as a match for which program you're talking about, but I certainly
let's get clarification
on
that.
Expectation
on
that. Is.
We'll bring that back.
Perfect. That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. DiLorenzo?
Nothing, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any of our partners down there? Okay. Only thing I would bring your attention to is that there are some vacancies on the boards. If you have a vacancy and you can fill it, particularly it looks like the CAC has a number of them, that would be helpful as well. And there's some information items in your packet. And with that, I'll ask for
adjourned.
We're adjourned. Thank you very much.